Welcome everyone to the Northern Affinity video podcast. So I'm Michael Edwards. I am the founder of the Northern Affinity. Thank you very much for joining today's discussion. Well, we'll go to our expert that we are speaking to very, very soon. But I also want to give you an update on what the purpose of this conversation is. So for me, there's twofold, really. Firstly, it's for you and I to learn something from the person that we are speaking to get new ideas, to stimulate thought. That's a great start for me. But secondly, for me, which is a big passion of mine, is to give a platform to the person I'm speaking to. It's an opportunity for really, really good people who are doing really, really good things to demonstrate that and for you to hopefully see that. So, and now that the kind of overall, all our contributors are these type of people, are small business owners, people are doing things for good. So please, if you could follow and subscribe, whether you're watching this as a video on YouTube or you're listening via your various podcast platforms, please do subscribe. Listen to our other contributors. There's been some fantastic discussions we've had in the past, and I'm sure we will have in the future. So thank you very much. I'm delighted to say now the video podcast is sponsored by Leeds Beckett University and their Help to Grow management training program. If you have a business, an SME that has between 5 and 250 employees, and you're looking at something to help you and your business grow, I would advise looking at this. It's 90% funded. It's a fantastic opportunity for so many people. The program's open now, so please do check it out, and I'll put all the details in the show notes. Enjoy the discussion. So, welcome to the latest episode of the Northern Affinity podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to say I'm joined by Kevin today. So, Kevin, thanks for joining me.
Hello there, Michael. Are you looking well today?
Oh, thank you very much.
Especially well today.
thank you. Appreciate it. So for those who are watching on the video podcast, you can see what we're talking about today, but I'm sure people, if not, have seen it on the notes. And we're going to talk all about psychology, when it's related to decision making. We're going to cover as much as we can in the usual about half an hour today, but it feels like one of those that might be a multiple episode type discussion. This, so we'll see. We'll see how it goes, and I'm sure we'll do it again. I'll do kind of offshoots of this, Kevin. But probably a good place to start, Kevin. Do you want to just quickly introduce yourself? Tell us about you and what you do, and then we can go into the details from there.
Indeed, yes. My name is Kevin Pritchard. I'm a chartered management accountant by profession, and I spend my time helping organisations to improve their business performance management and decision-making in the process. I've worked a lot in the public sector in the past, and I'm now trying to specialise more in the private sector as an independent management consultant. I'm trained up in performance management, and traditionally I'd go into an organisation and at board level and then work all the way down from board level all the way down throughout the organisation to set performance indicators for the organisation. I started off learning how to use the balanced scorecard. If people have heard about that, it's an ancient book now. I think it was written in 1996, and I've actually got an original copy of it, a first edition. There's a lovely metaphor at the start of that book. It starts off with, if you could imagine being a pilot, you're looking at the dashboard of your aeroplane, of an aircraft that's going from, say, London to America. You don't want to be looking at every individual flashing light on that dashboard. You want 5 or 6 indicators, which if they're all green, you know you're okay. You can put on automatic pilot, sit back and have a cup of tea. Well, that in a way is how an organization's performance management report should work. Each board meeting, the board should be able to pick up its report and go, yes, I don't know, say 10 or 14 is recommended in the balance scorecard. All those indicators are green. Next item on the agenda, we know we're doing well, as long as those targets have been met. They don't need to look at each individual key performance indicator that underpin those targets, because they're managed lower down the organisation. So my job is to go in there, agree with the board what those key performance indicators are at the top, and then go down through the organisation to ensure that each one of those performance indicators has a pyramid, if you like, of indicators leading up to the top. So you might, for instance, have as one of your indicators, customer satisfaction. And it'll just be one indicator, customer satisfaction. Is it green, is it amber, is it red, or you might have it on a score going this way, varying degrees of green, red, or orange. But beneath that, there will be a whole set of indicators that are being managed lower down in the organisation. If they're all being met, that indicator at the top is green. So that's basically in a nutshell. But as I've been working in very large organisations in the past, I found that there were standard sorts of discussions that took place at board level, where people were making decisions that didn't seem to be quite right. And I was always coming up with metaphors for explaining what might be going wrong in those decisions. And I had lots of sort of snippets, if you like, short stories, almost like an Aesop's fable, if you like. Aesop's fables for decision-making in your organisation. So I could have a nice pithy metaphor, if you like, to make people sit back and think. Then in about 2010, I think it was, I came across a book by Daniel Kahneman called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. And it was brilliant for me because what it did, it put a lot of labels onto the things I've been discussing in the past for me to enable me to be able to get across to people how their decision-making processes might be being made wrong. Now, a lot of this goes back to, you have to rewind a bit, the caveman mind. Now, there's various discussions going on at the moment. Does the caveman mind, is it really relevant? Is it true that our brains have not really evolved over the past 2 million years? Now, apparently, mankind's been around for 2 million years-ish. But the research that's been carried out on, they've been able to extract DNA from Neanderthal man and compare it to modern day man. They think the brain might have evolved by up to 10% over the last 50,000 years, which is not a magnificent amount. Now, I came across a piece of work by Luke Muehlhauser, who's big. He runs the Singularity Institute. He runs an institute now which advises the World Economic Forum on artificial intelligence. He's a player. Now, he came up with 6 indicators about 5 or 6 years ago to look at how mankind had progressed over the last 2,000 years. And he looked at 6 indicators. He looked at things like life expectancy at birth, technology measured by war making, won't go into the detail of that. He also looked at freedom, the amount of freedom people had as a measure, looking at how many people lived under a democracy, etc. He looked at the amount of energy that's been produced by food over the last 1,000 years per capita, if you like, all those indicators. There were 6 of them, and he monitored them over a 2,000 year period as best as he could. And they flatlined till about 1750. All those indicators flatlined. 1750. Then in 1750, they took off the Enlightenment, which brought about the Industrial Revolution, which obviously brought about the major technological advances we've had over the past 250 years. Now, my hypothesis, backed up by other people, the people's hypothesis is you could take a caveman, bring him through to 1750, the Enlightenment, and not a great deal will have changed. He'd be reasonably comfortable sat there thinking, oh, look, nice new big cathedral, or the boats are a bit bigger, and we've got some nice different kind of metal things, plates and whatever. But fundamentally, it wouldn't take him a long time to settle into that society. If he took someone born in 1750 and brought them through to the present day, however, different universe, they would probably collapse on the floor, failing to understand what the hell was going on. Technology has advanced at such a rate, and everything else has. Democracy has advanced, the GDP per capita has advanced, the average life expectancy 250 years ago was 30. There isn't a country in the world now that has that kind of life expectancy at birth. Average across the world about 60 now, so it's doubled in different places. It's changed. If you took a caveman, though, just think about that. His brain's not evolved over 2 million years or 50,000 years, we could definitely measure. And he's had to cope with all those different changes in a period of 250 years. It's no matter the struggle. Daniel Kahneman postulates fast and slow thinking in his book of the same name, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. And he came up with an experiment, which I love to quote at people because I think it illustrates, it's a perfect metaphor for the problem we've got. If a woman goes into a shop and buys a bat and a ball for their child, costs £1.10. Takes it home. The father says, oh, that's nice, a bat and a ball. How much did they cost? And she says, £1.10. And the bat cost £1 more than the ball. And he says, oh, how much did the bat cost then? Now, intuitively, our minds are hardwired to say £1. Everybody says £1. I said £1 when I'm trained in mathematics to degree level, and I say £1. Most people do. The cleverest brains in the world often say a pound, but it's not, because if you take 10 pence from a pound, it's 90 pence. You made a fundamental mistake there because your brain is hardwired to do that. Make very fast decisions. It doesn't want to expend energy sitting back and reflecting on it and thinking, oh, well, better think about that. It's obvious. Now you might think, what's that going to do with business? Well, I worked a few years ago with a very talented woman who was a fellow at the Institute of Chartered Management Accountancy. She was asked to produce an internal management report. One of the figures was how much VAT did we pay this year on £1.2 billion worth of sales. Now, if I say to you, an iPad costs £1,000, including VAT, how much does it cost excluding VAT? A lot of people say £800 because VAT is 20%, yeah? But 20% of £800 is £160.
Yeah.
So it's £960, yeah? So you're 40 quid out. On £1.2 billion, it was £33.5 million. So that's the kind of mistake that can happen because we make fast decisions. But the more and more you think about this, the more it can impact on your business. And I've got a really good example. I went to a conference on Friday, Nudgestock, fantastic, all about this kind of thing, the psychology of psychological mistakes that people make. There was a lady there called Anne-Marie Seagart. She's written a book called The Something Gap. It'll come to me in a minute. The Authority Gap. And what she did, she had noticed, as many women do, that they don't seem to be taken as seriously in organisations as men are. Now, you might think, okay, that's sexist and all the rest of it. However, all the data that she looked at does suggest this. If we go back to the caveman instance, this stuff is potentially hardwired into us. They did research on three-year-old children. Now, the three-year-old boys interrupt girls far more than they interrupt three-year-old boys in discussions and when they're playing together. Whereas three-year-old girls do hardly any interrupting. And you think, okay, fair enough then, so that's kids. But I mean, it really does come back to that fundamental hardwiring. Are we hardwired to make bad decisions? So you looked at the Supreme Court in America. Someone did something, it wasn't her. Someone did the research into this in the Supreme Court in America. One third of people in the Supreme Court in America are women. But they get two thirds of the interruptions. And 96% of those interruptions are by men. And there are lots of statistics you quoted in this presentation. I was fascinated by this because it's got numbers in. I'm a numbers man. I love numbers. These things are believable. 55% of Twitter users are women, but men journalists tend to get 4 to 5 times as many retweets as men. Another thing that was quite startling, but I suppose Esquire magazine, which I believe is a guy's mag, I don't know, I've never seen it. But they did a report in 2015 that was headed up the 80 most important books ever written that every man should read. You can Google this because I checked it out. I thought I needed a fact check this. 79 out of those 80 were written by men. The one that wasn't written by a man had an ambiguous first name. So it could have been a man or a woman.
Yeah.
It was a woman. J.K. Rowling changed the name, J.K. George Eliot. Woman, man's name. Women aren't even getting listened to is one of the issues. And these are the sorts of psychological biases that people may not. I wasn't really aware of this as much as it is. I mean, we talk about mansplaining. There's some great stories about mansplaining as well that she went into. Even women do it though, she said. It's not just a purely man on woman kind of thing. Women do the same as well. Without realizing these kind of biases are there, then we can't do anything to control it. So, you know, we need to start to think about how we can overcome that. And just being aware of these things can certainly help.
Yeah, and I guess that's where the how comes in, isn't it? Is that, you know, obviously the point of this type of discussion is to help people improve on something. And, you know, having awareness of an issue. That one being there is obviously good. And that's a start, isn't it? But then kind how do I improve on that?
The start process is being aware of it, but the other side of it is then what do you do about it then? But there's got to be education within organisations. And I've probably been guilty of this, although I can't think of any specific instances. I'm sure I have. Would have interrupted a woman in the middle of a meeting. And women do tend to get more interrupted in meetings than men do. And it tends to shut them up. It makes them feel insecure and all the rest of it. So we need to be made aware of that. And raising the amount of women that are employed at senior levels within organisations and highlighting their achievements far more than we have done in the past can be examples of that. I mean, there's a whole list that Marianne Seagate goes into in the back of her book, apparently. I've not read it yet, but those are just some of the recommendations she came up with. But it's basically raising that level of awareness. But she did research some companies that taken forward the fact that they should get more egalitarian in the sex mix. And those organisations tended to be more successful overall. So by being able to demonstrate those kind of figures to people will certainly put some impetus, I believe, behind changing the culture of organisations. But it is that very culture, I think, that needs to be changed. But it's the whole the culture of, it's education more than anything, I think. If you look at Caroline Perez's book, Invisible Women, I mean, she quotes some quite stark figures. There's one, for instance, where men are more likely to have accidents in a car, but women are 47% more likely to get injured. Women are 17% more likely to die as a result of a car crash. And the research she's done behind that demonstrates the fact that it's probably down to the fact that crash test dummies are designed around the male form, the skeletal form, the muscular form of men.
Yeah,
and cars have been designed taking all that into account and not reflecting on the fact that a lot of people are women. I mean, the bias just goes into the medical field. There was something on LinkedIn, and one of your followers posted last week. It was a very interesting one with regard to heart attacks in women. The symptoms of heart attacks in women are different than they are in men, but we're not aware of it. CRT training that can be public access information doesn't take this into account, and women are more likely, if they have a heart attack, to be misdiagnosed and more likely to die as a result. It's that training that needs to be done and the awareness that needs to be raised to overcome these issues.
Absolutely. And I probably gonna ask you a question now that we probably can't fully answer right now because it could be here for hours and hours and ever, but maybe kind of as much as we can is for people, we all make decisions all day and every day. Some minor, some bigger, some personal, some work related, all that kind of thing. What kind of things can we maybe look into in more detail? It might be actually a better way of saying this around the psychology of these decisions to help us, I guess, to help us make better decisions. You're not going to get everything right. I think we all know that, but make more good decisions.
One of the things I think that I'm trying to emphasize to people as I speak to them is something McKinsey came out with a report a few years ago in America. And they did a survey of all the top American 800 CEOs in America, and they all said cognitive bias training was top of the list of training requirements within an organization. You need to be aware of the biases that you have. There's a lady, and there's so much good stuff out there. There's a lady called Tamar Gendler. She talks about A leaves and B leaves, which is a bit cheesy, but I think it's quite good. And by just explaining a few things to people, they go, I think I'm right all the while. But suddenly I realize I'm making predictable mistakes. And she talks about, for instance, there's a horseshoe-shaped bridge in America that you can walk over, and it's got a glass bottom on it, 4,000-foot drop to the bottom. People pay to go on this for whatever reason. But they go onto this bridge, and they look down, see 4,000 feet drop through glass. And a lot of people panic and they get excited about it and palms sweat. And they are generally affected by it. But it's probably as safe a bridge as there is in the world. If it was a tunnel or if it was 2 foot off the ground, it wouldn't cause any issues at all. People would not go on it if they believed it was unsafe. But when they get on it, the A-leaf, as she calls it, takes over. It's automatic, irrational, that's why she calls it, A-leafs. And we've all got these sort of ALEs built in within us. And we almost need to do a cognitive bias audit. I made this up. A cognitive bias audit to try and test what our innate biases are. Because it's not until you know what they are that you can do anything about it. And some of these things are really stark. Can I quote you a story about judges? And there's an experiment that's been on judges, which has been repeated around the world. This one, quite scary in a way for me. Judges were asked, there was a concern that judges were not making consistent decisions, which is the very basis of what they should be doing when they're sentencing people. Judges were given criminal notes to check of people who, actual criminal notes, case notes, to say, okay, you've got to give a recommended jail sentence for this person. Actual notes, the person was going to jail because they were a habitual criminal and a jail sentence was apt. Before they gave the notes to the judge, they had a nine-sided dice. Now, I can't imagine a nine-sided dice. You have to stretch a dodecahedron, yeah, whatever it was. Anyway, they rolled it, but it was loaded to land on a three or a nine. Okay, and they would say to the judge before they looked at the notes, this is what the prosecution will be looking for in months as a sentence. And they rolled the dice, three or a nine. The judges, of course, would say, it's got nothing to do with the decision. I'm a judge. I'm going to go through this meticulously and come up with the right decision. The ones that had a nine rolled in front of them came up with a recommended sentence of 6 months. And the ones that had a three rolled in front of them came up with a recommended sentence of 2 months on average. You know, there's obviously a bit of variation. So it shows something as simple, it's called anchoring. Something as simple as putting the first piece of information into your mind stays apparent for an unrepresentative period of time. There's lots of experiments like this go on. But if you're not aware of that, then how can you mitigate against it? So I think a lot of this is about doing some kind of cognitive bias audit on the self, on yourself, on the organization, and then saying, okay, fair enough. How do we stop doing this, guys? You can play in marketing, this stuff is used a lot. Crazy things. If you give someone a hot mug of coffee or a warm mug to hold, they are more likely to act warmly towards you than if you give them a cold glass of water or a cold tin of Coke.
Okay.
Because that warmth transmits through to them and transmits through to the mind. Again, this has been peer-reviewed research. These things matter. And apophenia is one of my favourite ones. What does that mean? Pareidolia, it's also called. When you see the man in the moon, we're hardwired to see faces. If you put a clear piece of paper on something that looks like a human being from 200 yards away, everyone will see a face on it. Your brain will transmit a face onto it because it expects to see that. Unfortunately, your brain transmits information onto data as well. You might have five pieces of information and then say, okay, all those indicators are pointing one way. Therefore, we can make a decision based on that. But it might ignore some really important factors that have not been taken into account, which will be ignored. Oh, it doesn't matter, we've got these indicators that do that. But if you take account of a further set of information, you get a completely different image of what you're looking at. You see patterns in information. Correlation is not causation. You can actually demonstrate there is a correlation between, and this is, you can Google this for fun if you like, the number of births are associated with the number of stalks seen in certain countries.
Right.
It's a fact. There's a correlation there. And people see patterns where there are no patterns. That's where the story comes from, you know. So you've got to be very careful in not spotting patterns where there are no patterns. And the way to overcome this is to make sure, and making fast decisions, obviously, is one of the big sins that you can have. People act on hunches. And the best way to overcome this is to have pre-planning meetings, to talk about why you're doing what you're doing, to enable people to speak up. Now, the authority bias is one of the biggest problems you have in organisations, where the chairman of the meeting or the chief exec will say one thing and everybody falls in behind them because they don't want to speak up. Or groupthink, where you give everyone the chance to speak their opinion and you might have nine people in support of it. You're the 10th person that sees something wrong with this, but you won't speak up because you've got to fall into groupthink. Now, that happens consistently. organizations, if they're not aware of that and have not been trained up how to avoid that, and to give people the authority themselves to say, if you don't agree with anything, lads, it won't be held against you, kind of thing. Lads and ladies, don't be sexist here. So, and it's those kind of, it's more or less a training and awareness that has to be done about it. The planning, I could talk about this sort of stuff forever, but let's just do one more. There's a planning bias where people always think that the plans are going to come in on time and on budget. Biggest laugh of them all. And one of the reasons why they don't is because everybody's very optimistic at the planning stage because we want to get the plan passed.
Yep.
But there are various ways you can look at a plan and take it apart and test it and make sure that it is realistic before you decide to sign up to it. And one of the best things to do is after a project has been completed, you have to have post-project meetings and say things such as, what would you do differently if we could start all over again and learn by that experience and develop that learning process within organisations, as well as seriously looking at any plan that's proposed and looking at previous plans that have been done by different organisations and how far out of budget and time they run and that kind of thing.
So I was just thinking about something there, Kevin, about, you know, the decision-making stuff that, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we all make decisions of varying different degrees of importance, I guess, in business every day. But let's say we're making a fairly important decision about maybe the direction of the business, taking on a new employee, something like that. It's an important thing. I know, and I haven't really thought about it like this way until we've had this conversation, that one of the things I've got better at is, you know, you have that thinking or a discussion or whatever it might be, and then before a final decision make, go away and do something else.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, whatever that may might be, have my lunch, it might be go for a walk, it might be do some other work, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then come back. And now I'm not saying that when you then come back, you always make the right decision, but sometimes other things have kind of, my brain starts to compute other things. Actually, the problem with this decision is X or Y has come at that point, which I could have very easily made that decision. So is there something in this idea of, and you can't do it for every decision because you can't, I don't know, walk into a sandwich shop, think about what you're going to sandwich and what they say, I'll come back in half an hour and come back. That's just not life, is it? That is impossible. But yeah, in business,
if it's on an important point there, though, Michael, it's a thinking fast, thinking slow. Cognitive reflection is very, very important in the decision-making process. The old cliche of sleep on it is so important when you're making a decision. And we know from a talk we had lately, on sleep, very good talk we had lately, where how important sleep is to this process. Your mind will be working in the background on what you've been thinking about and will bring in different things of experience in the past over a period of time. The question on the bat and ball that we started off with, it's part of a cognitive reflection test, which was invented in America about 30 years ago to see how people think. That's the theory of it. And if you'd given yourself a bit more time and you didn't feel under pressure with that question, there's no doubt about it, you get the answer right. But your brain wants to make a fast decision, but you do need to sit back and reflect on it. Anyone can work out that obviously a pound less 10 pence is not a pound, but instantly you make the wrong decision. But if you sat back and reflected on it for a while, you'd have got it right because it's not a mathematical problem. It's the easiest mathematical illustration that I can think of that the brain does not think mathematically. And I love it when Rishi Sunak says, oh, we need more maths training in school. No, we don't. We need more thinking training in school, more logic training in school, more training of this nature, really, to get people to understand that what they think is true is not necessarily true. And the only real way you can overcome a lot of this is to be aware of it and to be aware of how you might be overcoming it. And a lot of it is down to diversity in organisations. If you can get a mix, and I'm not talking about just racial diversity in organisations or even sexual diversity in organisations, we're talking about people with different experiences in organisations. They will see things you can't see. They will say, well, if you do that, this might happen. You go, I've never even thought about that. And therefore, the decision will be influenced by that. There's a book by Matthew Syed called Rebel Thinking.
Okay.
Fantastic book. And that starts off with the problem that the CIA had with not forecasting 9/11 was down to a lack of diversity. everybody that was working in the CIA had a very similar background, similar training. You could almost have a tick box. Yeah, must have gone to Harvard, must have done this, must be that, must be that, must be an American through and through kind of thing. And they couldn't see the way that different cultures think. And then someone from a Muslim culture came into the organization, started to advise them, and all of a sudden the way of thinking changed about how they started to monitor terrorism. And the whole thinking process changed. And they think that if they've had a more diverse culture in the first place, they'd have seen, because all the clues were there about 9/11 coming, but they couldn't see them because the background of the people who were working there couldn't do that. And without that diversity mix of people, you don't see what is apparent to them. You don't see.
I can relate to this, Kevin, really, as well, because so for myself, I guess in a less serious scenario, but a similar kind of idea is, so where the town I was born in, the school I went to, everybody was very, very similar in terms of their socioeconomic background. Pretty much everyone was white, British, traditional, living in two up, two down, semi-detached houses. Not everyone, obviously, but on the whole, pretty much everyone was very, very similar. I remember when I went to university, all of a sudden, I was surrounded by people from all sorts of different socioeconomic backgrounds, obviously from people, different parts of the country, but different parts of the world as well, with all these different experiences. And how I talk about this a lot when I went to university. Forget about the education side of university. The thing that, for me, was the experience was being surrounded by other people with all these different backgrounds and experiences, and how it changed me massively in that period, because you had a wider variety of thinking. And it's something that I think, you know, there's a lot of people talk now about people not going to university, and I understand why, and there's the financial element of that. But one of the big things I would be keen to encourage people is that. That's a scenario which a lot, if you don't go to university, you're probably less likely to get in. Now, the world has changed over the 20-odd plus years since I left university, and we are more diverse just naturally. So it's probably happened a little bit, but it didn't then. But still, I still think if you went into that environment, you would experience that.
I mean, you can see some of the problems we had. Do you remember David Cameron's cabinet, the chumocracy? Yeah. When everybody had to come from Eton or Westminster, even Westminster was looked down upon. There's all the lower orders kind of thing. You know, you stay the mickey out of that. Exactly the kind of thing that can cause multitudes of problems. And we see it all the time where the people, the so-called elite people, they call themselves that. I don't know who christened them the elites. I hate the expression, but it's used a lot, isn't it? They just don't see the problems at the bottom, the problems that the normal working person has. And therefore, the decision-making process is not as good as it should be, causing like that diversity. And I think that's improving, certainly in the government, certainly the race mix and the sex mix is certainly, the sex ratio of male and female has certainly changed for the better. But it's all these kind of things. There's a lot of research which we could quote, and I could send details off to anybody who wants it, that clearly demonstrates that diversity in organisation improves the organisation profitably and by other measures such as staff satisfaction, staff turnover ratios and such like, change immensely if you've got more diverse organisations. And the whole flat structure thing about people being able to make decisions within the organisation themselves without going upwards, without going to finance, dare I say, as an accountant. There's a guy called Rory Sutherland, and he came out with a great story, well, a very, very pithy metaphor. The creatives in an organisation always have to justify what they want to do to the finance people or upwards to HR or wherever. The finance section never has to justify its decisions to the creatives before it makes that decision. The creatives always have to have it signed off, but the finance people never do. And there's that sort of linear relationship that needs to be brought across as well. And people need, and I suppose it's culture of any organisation is very important, and it comes from the top. And as the top of the organisation permits people to make decisions throughout the organisation without having to refer it upwards and downwards all the time, then it makes a faster organisation, but a diverse organisation that is trained up on the necessary stuff, such as this. I'm not saying this is the only training requirement anyone would have, but it's certainly a very important one. Absolutely. Then the organisation is more than likely, and we can demonstrate this with numbers and research, more than likely to be a more successful one than it otherwise would have been. I'm one of eight, in my opinion.
Do you know what, Kevin? I think we could, like I said right at the start, I think we could talk about this for literally the rest of time. So yeah, I think we need to look at getting further chats and kind of delving into different areas of this, because I think it's fascinating.
Lots and lots of nice, pithy stories that people may or may not want to listen to that illustrates the point I'm making. It's fascinating stuff. It really is.
Absolutely. And then hopefully what we've done here is kind of given people a flavour of why it's important to think about it and start, you know, start that journey. And kind of on that, Kevin, if anyone wants to kind of contact you, find out more about what you do, or just kind of connect with you, where's the best places to go and look for that?
Well, LinkedIn is probably the best at the minute. Obviously, Kevin Pritchard at LinkedIn. You can just Google me and find me there. And the company name is Preparaton. I'll spell that. I was being a bit pretentious when I invented the company name, but it's Latin. I've got a Latin O level. Not many people have got one of those. Great. Just passed it. It's Preperiton. Preperiton. Latin, it means for experts. Made you up in the pub one night. So you can get me at kevin.pritchard@properiton.com. Don't look at the website at the moment. It's down, but it will be up and running soon. I will be starting off a podcast called Mutant Thinking. I'm just waiting for the name to be copyrighted. It's in copyright judgment at the moment. I'll be putting out a lot of podcasts as well. So hopefully we shall speak again, Michael, in thunder, lightning, or in rain, when the hurly burly is done, when the battle's lost or won.
Oh, I have no doubt we will, Kevin. thank you. So, I mean, if anyone, I'll put all your details in the various show notes. Obviously, this goes out in various places as well for people if they need to find that. And for whatever reason, if you can't find Kevin, just give me a shout and I can point you in the right direction. That's for certain.
Oh, sure.
Like I said, I think this kind of feels like the first of a few we'll do of these, Kevin. So,
it's important stuff. But in a way, it's a kind of entertaining stuff. It makes people think. And what I always want to do is people to go away thinking, that's interesting. And perhaps change something they want to do. But anybody wants to just research cognitive biases and start to implement them with the learning from that within their organisation, is very likely to change in a positive way the organisation, the way things are done.
And that's what we're all about. So thank you so much, Kevin. Really appreciate your time. And like I said, I'm sure we'll do more of these, but really appreciate you coming on and giving us your wisdom.
Yeah, indeed. Till next time.